Penguin Random House Audio presents Stranger Care, a memoir of loving what isn't ours. This is the author, Sarah Centillis. 4C. Forever and ever and always. And for the 500,000 children in foster care in the United States and the people who care for them. Author's note. The names and identifying characteristics of some people mentioned in this book, including social workers, court advocates, and associates of the woman I call Evelyn, have been changed to protect their privacy. Preface. Faded pink construction paper letters taped to the wall of the Department of Human Services classroom spelled, "Welcome to DHS." Eric and I sat in the back, near the door, on blue cushioned chairs with wheels. On every long table, a scattered handful of hard candy, peppermints, butterscotch, Tootsie Pops. We'd eaten dinner at 4:45, so we'd arrive on time. Though the department's office was less than 10 miles from our house, class started at 6, and in Portland's traffic, the drive could take an hour, which it did. The classroom was cold. I took off my jacket, but not my scarf, thankful Eric had brought us insulated mugs of herbal tea. The facilitator stood at the front of the room. "Our goal at DHS is to keep biological families together," she said. "The first plan is always a return home plan, but in the meantime, kids need a safe place to go." A man in an orange sweater at the table next to us crunched one Tootsie Pop after another, scrolling through his phone's Facebook feed while the facilitator talked. "Kids in foster care are our most vulnerable citizens," she said, "and the state doesn't make a very good parent." She handed us posters outlining foster children's rights, access to free soap and shampoo, to clean drinking water, to a working phone. "Hang it somewhere visible in your home where your foster kids can see it," she said. She wheeled an ancient television into the middle of the room, inserted a VHS tape into the VCR, and pressed play so we could watch a video about being mandatory reporters, which meant when we were certified as foster parents, we would be required to report any suspected violence. As the video played, she sat with her back to the television, doing paperwork. When the tape froze and wavy lines filled the screen, she didn't notice until we told her. "Nothing important happens at the end," she said, and turned off the TV. I walked out of the classroom during a break and into a larger room with glass-walled offices on one side and a waiting area on the other. Couches, chairs, toys, games, multicolored rugs. A place for parents to visit their children who have been taken away. "Remember," the facilitator said when we returned, "forming a healthy attachment to a child is very different from making a claim on that child. Foster families have to parent knowing the child will leave." She looked around the room. "How many of you are relatives of a child in care?" she asked. And everyone, except Eric and me, raised their hands. Our classmates were there to be certified as foster parents so they could care for nephews and nieces and grandchildren whose biological parents couldn't care for them. "You're doing a good thing," she told them. "There are about 400 foster homes in this county. 60% of those homes are like you, relative care providers, but they take care of less than half of the kids in the system. The rest of the kids are living with people who aren't blood relatives." She gestured to Eric and me. "We call it stranger care," she said. I still think about that meeting in Portland 6 years ago, about that version of myself, with my hope and my fear pointed in the wrong direction, afraid I wouldn't be able to love someone else's child, unaware of the joy to come and the heartbreak, the helplessness. "Given what you know now, would you do it again?" people ask. And I know what they are trying to say is that they wish they could lift this grief from me. But it isn't the right question, because this is how we find you. Some say children come from stars. Look down from that hot, bright fire to this cool, green, blue, and choose their families. Others say children arrive by stork, winged through sky, cradled by beak and blanket and brought to doorstep. But you will come by phone. For this reason, we have a landline, a word I like to say out loud because of the earth it names and roots me to. Plumb line, divining rod, beacon to find your way home. There will be a ringing and a voice saying, "Are you ready?" Then we will ask questions and the voice will answer and you will wait, patient, already knowing our yes because you decided it. You will teach us that family is everywhere, well beyond the cul-de-sacs of our narrow minds, taking the edges of the ideas we have about who can be loved and who belongs to whom and stretching them wide. There will be a social worker who will tell us there will always be holes in your story, missing pieces we can't provide. You won't be able to tell them what it felt like when they kicked your ribs, she will say. And I will want to tell her, I knew you before I had ribs. I knew you before bone, before marrow. I knew you when we were dust, gathered and mixed with water and animated by wind. Seed, egg, division, explosion, countless are the ways you've been born. You have so many mothers, the one who birthed you, the one who brought you home, the earth, the mountains visible outside your bedroom window, the three spruce trees in our yard, ocean, rocks, rivers, moon, stars. I remember a children's book about a baby bird looking for his mother. "Are you my mother?" he asked a cat. "A dump truck? A wrecked car?" "Are you my mother?" he asked a cow. "How can I be your mother?" said the cow. "I am a cow." "Are you my mother?" he asked a dog. "I am not your mother. I am a dog," said the dog. But in your story, the one I tell you now, everyone answers, yes. Part 1. Show yourself to be a mother. Trailing spouse. I always imagined myself a mother. I kept a list of possible names for my future children, pictured myself pregnant and listening to fast fetal heartbeats, looking in wonder at the image on the screen. But I had reservations. I'd absorbed the messages in the cultural ether that framed motherhood as both holy work and trap. My ambivalence grew. When Eric and I married in 2004, we agreed we'd eventually have a child, but we were busy doing other things. Writing dissertations, writing books, chasing academic jobs around the country, and by the time we started talking in earnest about becoming parents, I was in my mid-30s, and Eric was close to 40. We moved to Southern California in 2007 and lived in a townhouse subsidized by the university where we both taught. Eric had been hired for his first tenure-track faculty position in a graduate school of education, preparing teachers for public school classrooms. I was the trailing spouse, language that reminded me of the signs along some California highways that show an adult holding the hand of a small child who appears to float in the wind, feet not touching the ground. Eric liked our life as it was. He liked our freedom, the ease of escaping to the Sierras to backpack and to the Alabama hills to climb, the unfettered time for activism, for work that might make a difference. We could turn our attention and our resources toward all children, he reasoned, not just our own. "You're enough for me," he said. "I'm okay if it's just the two of us." My friends had
Sample complete. Ready to continue?